Open.
Outspoken.
It's Ophthalmology Off the Grid.
An honest look at controversial topics in the field. I'm Blake Williamson.
I'm Gary Wirtz.
Welcome to a new episode of Ophthalmology Off the Grid. In this episode, Drs. Blake Williamson and Gary Wirtz invite Dr. Nate Radcliffe to share his experiences managing complex patients with advanced glaucoma. Thank you for listening. Support for this podcast comes from Bryn Mawr Communications. BMC produces a number of informative podcast series spanning a variety of topics in ophthalmology. Discover a new show at itube.net/podcasts.
Welcome to the episode of Ophthalmology Off the Grid. We're your host, Gary. What's going on, man? How's life? You got back from AECOS okay?
Yeah. We survived AECOS, another great meeting. If anyone hasn't been to AECOS Aspen, you're really missing out. So a little shout out to the AECOS meetings. Fantastic time there. We're back. You're back in action also. And tonight we have, I don't want to oversell this because he'll feel awkward about it, but I do like making him feel a bit awkward. But I have to say, one of the funniest people in ophthalmology, I don't think intentionally funny. He's just an awkward person. Wouldn't you say, Blake?
Well, and he also has a six pack. Right off the bat, we need to mention his abdomen, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really intimidating. I mean, he intimidates me in a lot of ways, but with all of that preface, we do have the one and only Dr. Nate Radcliffe with us. Nate, you're a glaucoma surgeon who is actually amazing to hang out with. And we are happy to have you on tonight, bud.
Thank you. This is fun. I couldn't imagine two better folks to chat war stories with. So thanks for including me. And it's great to be here.
Yeah, this is our first time. Gary, I'm thinking about it. Like, I don't know if we've had a hardcore glaucoma person on this season. In fact, I know we haven't. And like, man, like that, like what's crazy to me is, you know, what you and I would consider probably a horror story can just be routine for glaucoma docs, especially, you know, people who are seeing high volume, lots of surgery, very intense stuff. Like I know that Dr. Radcliffe is, it's like, you know, I could only imagine some of the things that he's kind of had to go through. Nate, I mean, wouldn't you say like day to day, like you guys just encounter a lot more sick eyes, obviously, than what we do.
Yeah. I mean, the eyes I get come in different categories of sort of troubled. You know, like a lot of them have had surgery outside the United States. You know, and I like to say a lot of them have had 2/3 of a cataract surgery. So, you know, which can lead to glaucoma. You know, as you know, the reason why we're so meticulous about cleaning things up is so that, you know, because glaucoma can be a complication. I also get a lot of referrals from other glaucoma specialists, you know, and usually it's not to do the first glaucoma surgery, you know, but maybe like the second or third or, you know, even beyond. And so, yeah, I really, you know, and I love it. I practice in the Bronx and in Queens, and there's a high level of pathology there to begin with. And so, but, you know, once you get comfortable with that playing field, it's a very rewarding place to practice because if you can help someone that, you know, where another doctor said, you know, I don't think there's much more that could be done here and you can turn things around. It's really rewarding.
Yeah. So walk us through what, you know, because I think like a horror story for me would actually be like living a day in the life of you just like on a good day. So an average day look like for Nate Radcliffe in the Bronx or in Queens or in surgery, what is your day to day? Because I mean, I don't think I could do it.
Yeah. So, you know, I see a large number of patients and so many are people I've seen many times over almost a decade or more. And, you know, many of them are fine. They're fine on their drops. No complaints. We're refilling meds. And then you just walk into a room, you know, and in my EMR, if the pressure's above 21, it's a red font on the screen. So before I can even see, you know, what the pressure is, I just see the red on the EHR, like as I'm walking into the room. And immediately you're like, uh-oh, you know, and, you know, you kind of parse through, you know, I mean, I put a lot of people on Dymox every day. You know, I still use pilocarpine. You know, I have to use absolutely everything. And that, you know, like today was a surgery day. You know, I did maybe 7 Omid valves along with my cataracts. And, you know, so there's just a lot of that. Some of those are easy Omid valves where, you know, there's not much going on. You just have to get the pressure down, and others are more complicated.
So Nate, you spent some time at Cornell. You've been in academic settings. Do you, is there a case or a patient that you remember from that time when you were kind of involved in that setting, or maybe more recently that sticks out in your mind as like something that you wanted to kind of share what you would consider a horror story?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a lot. I usually talk about them with my therapist. So I'm really glad.
Is that Rob Weinstein?
Yeah. We'll send you the bill later. Yeah. Okay. You feel free to share. It's a safe space.
Yeah, safe space. No one's listening, right?
No one's listening. Nope. Okay. You're good. Go to silence here.
Yeah. So the thing about glaucoma that I think maybe isn't appreciated, that in these cases I now sort of sniff them out, but you know, you forget that not all eyes are going to be happy with a normal pressure, you know? And so I will get an eye sent to me that has like a pressure of 56. And then there'll be a cataract too. And, you know, how long? So then the two things you got to know is how old is this patient? Do they have high blood pressure or something? And how long has the pressure been 56? Shot up last week, you know, that's better. If they're older, it's been that way for a long time, you're starting to get into trouble. And then you got to decide whether you're going to take the cataract or not, knowing the cataract's going to have to go. But I mean, if you tried taking a cataract out on an eye where the pressure is 60, because it turns out the vitreous really likes to keep that high pressure, you know, so you start getting in the anterior chamber and you're fighting against that, you know, that vitreous. So, you know, you kind of know what you're walking into, and you have to talk to the patient. Your eye may not love this when we bring the pressure down. Of course, the risks I'm talking about are like choroidal effusions with a pressure 20, you know, which can happen. And you're saying, like, you're patting yourself on the back, I got your pressure from 60 to 20. And then you look at the eye and the eye is basically saying, I miss having a pressure 60. You know, my choroid's not used to this. One of the things I have to do, you know, that, you know, I don't think is that common is in some cases, I just have to make a decision to do a vitrectomy, even though I've got a lens in the bag and, you know, you haven't had a complication, you know, the lens is intact, but just kind of looking at the eye and recognizing that this eye isn't going to be able to keep a formed chamber very well if I, you know, leave a vitreous in here. And it's always a judgment call, but, you know, the technique I have for that is just one pars plana incision, 3 millimeters, 3.5 millimeters back from the limbus. I keep my irrigation in the anterior chamber, and I just do a nice, you know, core anterior vitrectomy. And in these cases where you're fighting the shallow anterior chamber and you know you're going to have to put a tube in and you're already having trouble finding space, it's just better to do that vitrectomy right off. So this brings me to my case where, you know, I may have met a match, and it was really an interesting kind of challenge because I have this 83-year-old with exfoliation syndrome and a cataract and a pressure of 56. And the eye's just been sitting there like this. And, you know, I'm like,
what kind of field would this patient have? Even hard to tell because the cataract is there. Yeah. Or no. Yeah.
It was at least a 2200 cataract. There's exfoliation, you know, which is already going to cause all sorts of problems. And, you know, so, and the pressure's high, but I really felt like I had to take the cataract out. So I go in, I get the cataract out, I get a lens in the bag. It's all great. I'm like, we did it, you know, and all I got to do now is put a tube in and, you know, we're home free. And at some point in time, again, lens in the bag, there was like nothing abnormal about the case. It was a dense lens. And basically the lens just sort of moves aside and like a nice bit of vitreous just makes its way through the zonules, you know, because you just have that pressure. So it was like the vitreous auto dissected some zonules and comes into the anterior chamber. And so I'm like, well, can't leave that. And I probably can just get that vitreous back through a vitrectomy. And, you know, the lens will still be fine. I mean, there was seemed to be reasonable zonular support. So I start doing my vitrectomy. And at this point in time, the choroid says, since you're making space, I might grow a little bit, which of course is a perfect setup for that, right? And you know, you assume it's probably a choroidal hemorrhage, and I just see the red reflex start to go, and you know, now you're in a bit of a pickle because the more vitreous you take, probably the more you know, the more the choroid's going to grow. So the treatment is kind of to repressurize the eye. My plan, of course, was to do an Ahmed valve, which I'm now thinking this eye isn't going to tolerate. It's just not going to tolerate. So, you know, what I had to do at that point in time was I did enough vitrectomy to get the lens back in its happy place. Got to think carefully about whether you want to introduce Myocol in a situation like that. Like, it'd be nice to get the pupil down, but at the same time, that'll bring your chamber flat in people. So I skipped it for this patient. You're probably going to go more towards the atropine route. And then I had to just pivot to transscleral cyclophotocoagulation instead of the Ahmed valve, which is always a tough thing to do. And, you know.
And do you have the opportunity to do that intra-op?
Yep.
Okay. Okay.
I did it intra-op.
Transscleral?
Yep.
Okay.
An aggressive diode laser where I could seal the eye. Maybe even leave a little bit of viscoelastic in the anterior chamber, hammer them with Diamox, you know, to kind of just give yourself that 12 to 24 hours. And it's an interesting thing, actually, like when you leave viscoelastic in the chamber and you're worried about it shallowing and you use Diamox, it actually just gives you like a couple days of stability where the eye's hopefully not making much aqueous and you can keep that chamber, let all your wounds seal and then kind of get away with it. And that one worked out fine. You know, it was a limited suprachoroidal hemorrhage. The lens stayed in position. I had like a round pupil at the end of it. You know, the vision remained at, you know, 2200 or something suboptimal. But somehow the diode, or at least the phaco opening up the angle, was enough to get pressure control. And the postoperative course was reasonably smooth. But it was horrifying.
Well, I'm going to tell you about a really tough case of mine the other day. There was a patient who had glaucoma and cataract surgery, or needed cataract surgery. And I did the cataract and I just couldn't get the hydrus quite right. Can you believe that?
Yeah, I can.
What did you do? Did you take it out?
And I took the hydrus out, and that was it.
Did you do a goniotomy?
Well, kind of in the process. Yeah. The process. So that's my really bad, horrible glaucoma story. What do you think about that?
Was the rep in the room?
No.
That's not so bad then.
Not so bad. I'm joking, of course, but yeah, that's crazy. I mean, Blake, where do you even start with that? I mean,
what occurs to me listening to Nate talk is that, and I want to make sure I'm saying this the right way. You know, as a surgeon during the procedure, I don't think it makes it any better necessarily. However, psychologically, at least, the stakes seem a little lower. If you have a diseased eye that is already going blind, you mentioned the HVF was just a central island. It's not unlike our retina colleagues where, gosh, the bar is so low because these are sick eyes. And so it's almost like in retrospect, listening to the horror stories on the refractive side, like so much of what we deal with is psychological. And it's unmet expectations because these are healthy, pristine eyes who have complications. And it doesn't mean that ours are worse. It doesn't mean that, like, you know, we have to deal with more. It's just different. Like for you, this is kind of part of what you do. And so as a result, you know, the patients understand that, you know. And so I don't know. That's kind of what I was thinking about when I was listening to you. I was like, yeah, I haven't seen a suprachoroidal image. But, geez, this patient was already mostly blind. To 2200, that's legally blind already. And you were just trying to prevent that nerve from getting snuffed. It's just a different ball game entirely.
Yeah, one of the things that I, you know, you get fooled a couple of times in your career where you know the patient's visual potential isn't perfect from the glaucoma. You felt like you explained it to them, and then you do a procedure and they're saying, why aren't I seeing better? And you're saying, we knew you weren't going to see better. We did this so you can keep the vision you have. And, you know, I don't fall for that anymore, you know, because this is my job. When I go, when I bring a severe glaucoma patient to the operating room, to make sure they understand that the base case scenario is losing all visual, you know, and sometimes I'll say, like, just close your eyes and that's what you're going to see in a month if you do nothing. So that's your base case. You know, you'd have to continue on your meds to keep the vision for another month, but you're going to get there a month, 4 months, something like that. You know, I'm trying to keep you with the vision you have looking at me right now. You know, and it's a tough pill, but I've learned you can't, as much as you want to give patients hope with your surgeries, you really have to be, you know, really kind of like, and it's a little against my nature, but really firm on, you know, what they're really dealing with. And, you know, you have to make sure their expectations, you know, are met. And then when something happens, you have to remember that you told them and have the confidence to remind them and make sure you document it, because, you know, I'll look back in the chart and ask my tech, did I put my phrase in there? It's in there. I don't put it in there unless I said it. So I know we had this discussion. I understand it's easy to kind of wish that we were going to do more for you, but trust me, this is as good as can possibly be achieved. And so
one thing I, you know, when I have talked to, you know, my share of glaucoma patients in the past, and, you know, as I see them, you know, in my present, I talk about it like a spinal cord injury. I say glaucoma is a neurologic injury. It's an insult. And just like a spinal cord injury, you know, we can't fix it. What we can do is try to preserve the nerve that you have and prevent it from getting worse, but there's no going backwards from where you are right now. And so the only hope we have is to keep what you've got, or at least slow down the progression of this. And so that's a tough cat. That is very challenging though. Psychologically, because you see it on their face, they're coming to you because they've been told in some way, shape, or form that you're the best person around. You're the person who can help them when others can't. And you know that they're sort of, they might know really there's nothing to be done, but they're kind of hoping that you're going to have some good news for them. So in that line, you know, what are the things that keep you up at night? You know, I mean, you deal with a very high acuity population. I feel like not a whole lot bothers you just because you're a super competent surgeon. I think there's very few things that you have not seen. You rarely get surprised. But what are the cases that kind of keep you up at night, or the things that you go home and you're like, dang it, that just kind of was a bummer, like for you at this stage? And how's that changed maybe over time?
You know, the way I conceptualize that is that, you know, you know, and I am a high volume glaucoma surgeon, you know, and that it's great for me. And it's one of the reasons I left academics is because I do 10 times as much surgery as I did in academics. And I feel like I'm 10 times better. If I ever need heart surgery, I have one question is who does the most volume? And I don't want to know anything else about that person. That's it. Because I'm a believer that volume is a predictor of surgical success. It is the best one. And people don't love hearing that. You know, they want to think like, oh, I want this doctor to spend like a whole month on just my case. And you're like, well, how are they going to get good if that's how they approach it? And so, you know, and I, you know, people are often surprised to hear me say that. They tend to think a surgeon who's doing a lot of surgeries in a day must be rushing. But the reality is, if you're doing high volume, you have to be excellent at it, or else you couldn't keep yourself in business. And ultimately, volume and experience is the best teacher in medicine. But back to your point, because I do volume, the numbers are something like this. Any glaucoma surgery has roughly a 70% success rate. So I'm going to do this perfect surgery, and there's going to be 30% of patients who don't respond despite everything having been technically achieved. They may go on to a second surgery, and guess what the numbers are there? 70% success rate with another 30, you know, and I just have these wonderful people through no fault of their own who just keep falling on the wrong side of that 70-30 split. And now they've had, you know, two or even three, you know, tube shunt surgeries, you know, MIGS, lasers. I mean, every little thing that I have to throw at them, and they just keep not responding, and they're going to lose vision. You know, they're going to get worse. Sometimes the patient gives up, before they fall on the right side of that 70-30 split. I'm most grateful for the patients of mine who actually just say, I get that, and let's keep plugging ahead, because I know where this is headed if we don't intervene. And, you know, if I haven't managed to instill the confidence in a patient and I see them give up before we get that one more reasonable chance to get them on the right side of the 70-30 split, it's really, it's tough. You know, I don't like writing in the chart, patient refuses further intervention, understands they will lose vision from glaucoma, you know, and, you know, it always breaks my heart to see a new patient with one no light perception eye that's never even had glaucoma surgery. I mean, that's just, you know, they never, you know, and the sad thing about those patients, or sometimes patients will have their first glaucoma surgery the week before they were going to lose their vision anyway from glaucoma. And then they say, well, I'm not having a surgery in my good eye now because my other eye went bad from the surgery. And you're like, I can see why you'd feel that way, but it is not, definitely not the case. That eye went blind from glaucoma and had a perfectly fine surgery, which kind of brings us to snuff, the snuff phenomenon, which, you know, you've probably heard something about snuff, like, you know, patients with severe glaucoma sometimes go blind from a glaucoma surgery. And it just happens randomly. And so I had a very talented medical student look at some of my data, and it was really quite predictable who was getting the snuff problem. And it was basically late referrals. They'd already lost 3 points of fixation around their center vision, and it came in generally with pressures over 30. And, you know, I use the term sort of dead man walking, where, you know, the game has probably been lost. And your surgery may occur at the time when they were going to lose their last bit of vision, and you're going to be the one who does the surgery, and they're probably going to blame you for it. And so then the question comes is, do you believe that? And, you know, I don't believe it's a surgery. I believe it was their disease. And then secondly, you know, is it right to deprive all people in that scenario of a surgery that you know can help many or most of them, because you're worried of looking like the person who led to their vision loss for doing the right thing in a small fraction of them? And so that's when I just have to say, I don't believe it. I talk to the patient about it. And I'm usually in favor of doing something. I know in my career, I'll save more people from blindness by intervening, but unquestionably, there are just going to be some patients who aren't going to understand it and will end up, you know, putting some of their blame on me. And you have to just have the, you know, conviction, you know, that you are doing the right thing. You talk to them about it, you know, you gave them the information, and kind of live with some of those things. But, you know, it'll beat you up emotionally. And that's why when glaucoma specialists get together, you know, we share stories like this, you know, all the time, and, you know, and try to help each other through it.
Yeah. That's, I tell you what makes me think about that is, oftentimes we have to kind of fight against our own instincts as interventional people, right? So I'm very much like your mindset, you know, having learned a lot from you. And, you know, I had to learn after my first couple of years in practice, that patient that's got bilateral cupped out and just have central islands in both, that is someone that I should refer. I'm not a comprehensive glaucoma. I'm not even a comprehensive ophthalmologist. I'm not, definitely not a comprehensive glaucoma surgeon. I don't do tubes or incisional surgery at all. And my dad taught me, I think it was my second year, he's like, you never want to be the last person to operate on someone right before they go blind. And that's not an insensitive comment. That's just an honest comment from someone who is not a glaucoma fellowship trained doctor, even though I pretend to be at times because I love all the devices and technologies and I love glaucoma. And I had to kind of force myself because I said, gosh, this patient, I'm looking at this patient, their patient, you know, their pressure's, I don't know, 22, they're on two bottles of meds. I bet you with an Omni 360, I could buy them another year or two. But I had to say, wait a second, is that the best thing for this patient now? So on the flip end, I'm just kind of, I know we have a few minutes left, but I'm just kind of curious on the flip side, that not that you already mentioned, you don't see a lot of mild to moderate people like I do, but have you ever had just a wacky response to like an SLT, or have you ever done a stent and the patient moves and the iris tears? Because I have. I've had patients who paradoxically pressure increased right after SLT. Maybe the ciliary body was hit. Who knows? Maybe it was a weird inflammatory reaction, surgery, even something like that. I have had patients where I'm stenting and they move and the iris root tears and it's a big hyphema. And that, to me, that's more on our world where like that wasn't their expectation. I wasn't telling that stent patient to expect that at all. And so to me, that was, I had to kind of back out of that a little bit emotionally. I was kind of a wreck. Now they all did fine, But in the moment and postoperatively, it's like, damn. So have you had anything like that, or you just don't see that patient?
No, I see them. But what I would say, Blake, is that, like, I think I know this. I know these patients a little better. I just meet them later. But the eyes are still tricksters, you know, and, you know, I believe that, like, the way I think about glaucoma is it is here to fool us. I mean, I went into this field with all arrogance, thinking, like, how tough is it going to be to get the pressure down? Like, let me pick the easy field, you know, and of course, this disease outsmarts everyone. It outsmarts patients by slowly stealing vision. That's why it's called the sneak thief. But the eyes have all sorts of bad tricks. And just because you're meeting that eye at the beginning of its glaucoma career doesn't mean that it's playing fair. And so, you know, great examples. I'll have some with glaucoma only in their right eye. I'll operate on the right eye. And then the left eye starts going nuts. Weird things. Very high. One time the pressure's 45. Oh, I've never had above 16. Okay. Well, I've checked your pressure 6 times in the past 2 months. You've been getting annual pressures for 4 years. So I now have more data on your left eye. We're just learning it was a bad player. And it's married to a horrible player that just needed severe glaucoma surgery. So it's more likely, when a lot of times we see these IOP spikes after procedures that went just fine. You know, I often think you're just getting to know the eye better. And in some ways, you know, here's a great example. We've all seen this. Any eye that has a pressure spike after a laser iridotomy was so much further along than you imagined that their meshwork was about to go. That's someone who in a year or two was about to start having pressures in the 30s or 40s. You put a teeny amount of extra pigment while you're fixing the underlying pathology, and you learn that that meshwork was already about to go. Does that mean you shouldn't have done the iridotomy? No, that means you definitely needed the iridotomy. Does any doctor in that position feel great about doing that laser? No, but I've seen it enough times to know that it's still the right decision. It's actually proving that they really needed it. But no, you know, the psychology of those moments are different. So, you know, it's a bad disease. The eyes, they trick you, they lull you into it. You know, how many of my patients have 2 good pressure measurements, think their disease must be mostly gone, take a year off, come back almost blind in an eye? I sadly see stuff like that all day long. And that's what glaucoma does. It tricks you, you know, it fools you. It doesn't follow patterns. You know, we all do pattern detection in ophthalmology, and glaucoma really tries to trick you into either a false sense of security or sometimes into overtreatment, you know, which also can be, you know, as problematic.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you brought up a point about iridotomies. I noticed a lot of my iridotomy patients would come back, and I had a patient say, you know, ever since you did that laser, I don't have any migraines anymore. And I have started to ask my patients after iridotomies, I ask them, do they have migraines? And then after the iridotomies, I ask them if their migraines have gone away. And it's amazing the number of patients who are maybe in their, let's say, mid-40s, who are hyperopic and, you know, get an iridotomy, and magically they don't have migraines anymore. And what does that tell us? They didn't have migraines to begin with. They were in intermittent angle closure. And it was just being managed as a migraine because it's the great trickster. And so I think that's another one of those things that maybe underdiagnosed or underappreciated in this disease process that continually fools us. So it's, you know, good point about the iridotomy when you get a pressure spike, but also just, the more questions we ask and the more we understand our patients, you know, they can be amazing teachers for us, and we can figure out maybe what we're missing.
Well, I'll tell you what, I appreciate you coming and spending some time with us, Nate. It turns out that, you know, stuff that scares us probably is just not the same thing. You got some thicker skin. It's not just the Bronx kind of giving you some armor. It's what you choose to do. And we need more people like you. I had a patient today that was, you know, referred in you know, could have had glaucoma surgery 5 years ago, but they live an hour and a half away in small town Mississippi, and you know, no one ever offered them anything. And so the more we get this message out, you know, the better. You're one of the guys that are leading that charge. So thanks for coming on and chatting with Gary and I.
Thank you, and I think that's a great point to end on. A lot of this stuff is better off addressed early. It does fall to any cataract surgeon, comprehensive ophthalmologist, cat refractive, to do what they can to address it. All sorts of amazing new technology to intervene earlier that's safe. And, you know, we don't have time machines yet for glaucoma patients. So until then, early intervention is the way to do it. It was great. Great coming on with you guys.
That's awesome. Well, on behalf of Blake and myself, this has been Ophthalmology Off the Grid. Until next time, see ya.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Ophthalmology Off the Grid. And thank you to our guest, Dr. Nate Radcliffe. Tune in to future episodes to hear more horror stories from top ophthalmic surgeons.